Please keep in mind, the views expressed on the Thin Men podcast reflect those of the hosts and the hosts alone. They are not necessarily representative of the Myrna Loy Center or its staff. Thank you.
Welcome to the Thin Men podcast. I'm Biggs.
I'm Zach.
And we're freezing in here.
Yes, we are. Montana winter has hit.
It has, but there's still nice warm things going on inside the Myrna Loy.
We've got a steamy little film called The Blue Room. We'll talk about that today. We've got the Hot-Blooded Assassins live on stage this weekend and next weekend. And we will have an interview related to that this episode with two of the stars of the show, Sam Williamson and Nick Pavlich.
I think it was a pretty interesting interview. We basically just talked about their craft. We, you know, related some funny stories here and there.
We got a little bit of everything.
Yeah, and of course we talked about the play upcoming. So
yeah, so we cover a whole bunch of ground with them. They're two really cool guys. I think you'll like talking to them.
So that being said, let's kick off with the interview.
And we are joined now by Sam Williamson and Nick Pavlich, two of the stars of the upcoming play at the Myrna Loy Center, Assassins. Hi, guys. Nice to have you here.
Hey. Hello there.
Which one's Sam?
Yeah. That's me. That's me. This is okay. Sam Williamson right here.
And who do you play, Sam?
I play Sam Bick, because I can only play characters named Sam, or else I get confused.
All right.
And so you're like the Tony Danza musicals?
Basically, the Tony Danza of everything. Life.
Oh, I do have one question if you're like Tony Danza.
Hit me.
Who's the boss?
Me.
All right.
I'm always the boss.
And Nick, who do you play?
I play John Wilkes Booth.
All right. I like that. Can you give us a little taste of the Booth voice?
I can give you more than a taste.
Oh, yeah. That's what I like to hear.
A whole loving spoonful.
So, I would like to start you guys off with a question that is very actor specific. Your answer will vary from actor to actor, and
probably not, but go ahead.
He's not an actor. He's really John Wilkes Booth. Just drug him in.
I don't know about you guys, but when I'm taking on a role, I try to find some person or various people to draw attributes from that I sort of look at as my spirit guide in the role, the person who will help me translate myself into a different self. So, for instance, playing Chulgosh in Assassins, I do everything with the question, how would Bruce Springsteen do this? Ooh. So, who do you do? First of all, do you do something similar where you sort of look at people in the world and try to meet, whether it's celebrities or people you know or political figures or what have you? And if you do, what people are you using for these specific roles?
At least in this production, I don't know if I've ever done that ever. My character tried to assassinate Richard Nixon, 1971. And just the whole motif, the whole everything that comes out of his mouth is so angry and so anti-government, anti-establishment, anti-Nixon. One thing that kind of has come to me has been just punk rock. And going through all of high school listening to nothing but The Clash, it's always there. But this was kind of a time that I thought, you know, I can try to physicalize that into a person and it actually makes sense for once. It's kind of what he is. You know, he just is punk rock. I mean, there's nothing more punk rock than trying to hijack a plane and crash it into the White House. Am I right?
No,
I mean,
that's as punk rock as it gets.
That makes Sid Vicious look like frickin' Nancy Pelosi. I mean, that is punk rock. And so that's kind of, I guess, what I've tried to embody.
Okay.
As far as that question goes.
So you look for something you can latch on to that you can relate to in some way and pour it into it from yourself. So you try to find something you feel comfortable and familiar with the concepts of, the grander ideas.
A launching off point, an impetus, something to flavor.
To catalyze everything else you
exactly,
do.
Exactly, yeah. Something to give focus to, yeah.
How about you, Nick?
No, it's really hard for me to talk about, like, my method, because I'm pretty jealous, actually, of, like, how I do what I do. And I don't... This is the first big musical I've ever done, and it's kind of a whole different kettle of fish, but I draw a lot from the music itself. I think Sondheim is a genius, you know. I've never really realized it before. I haven't been exposed to a lot of his work. Just their songs themselves are so emotionally charged and so wrought with this certain type of energy that it really gives me a lot to go on. as an actor.
And various like breeds of passion that you can use as a pathway for the character, things like that.
Yeah, well, I'm a big believer in storytelling through song. I don't like most musicals that I've seen. And I think the big difference here is that I think the songs are connected to the rest of the show in the same way that the scenes are connected, and that they're all advancing, you know, a certain idea. And that's really, really, really important to have that sort of cohesiveness. And, you know, just like, yeah, the big song, my big number, The Ballad of Booth, I think is one of the most beautiful songs I've ever sang. It's a great song, and by the end of it, you have, I think, a definite understanding of Booth, sort of where he's coming from, him, why this was so important to him that he kill Abraham Lincoln, one of the most beloved figures ever in American politics. But by the end of that song, Ballad of Booth, I think there's a real genuine sense of compassion for this character and sympathy.
So has this swayed the way that you look at John Booth, or do you just look at it as a fictional work?
Yeah, both. Well, it's made me do a lot of research about him that I, you know, is completely ignorant.
So what's some things that you learned?
Well, he was a young man. He was 26. He was an actor, a very, quite a very popular actor. Sam told me this, actually. He's a theater buff. So John Wilkes Booth's older brother was another actor, probably even
the Brad Pitt of his time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Even more famous and a bigger name than John Wilkes Booth. And he is the reason why there's all this bad juju surrounded by saying Macbeth.
Do you want to elaborate on that for our listeners?
Go ahead, Sam, tell them.
Well, so there was the Astor Place riot, which was this big, big riot that happened in a theater. Just out of nowhere, all of a sudden, people started hissing and booing, and fire broke out, and people died. And it was John Wilkes Booth's brother who was playing Macbeth, who was in a pseudo rivalry with a British actor over who was the Shakespearean actor, right? And so people who were on the British, I can't recall his name, who were on his side, came and watched this American version of Macbeth as soon as he came out and started speaking lines. They were just appalled at this American trying to do Shakespeare, and so they started throwing things and booing and hissing, and it broke out. And that's one of the reasons they say you don't say Macbeth in the theater.
I want to take this back to the beginning of
wrangle it in.
Yeah,
wrangle
please, it in. Come on.
So we're always going to go to Macbeth. Yes, always.
So we not quite that far, but I mean the beginning of the play, I guess. So,
okay.
So we've heard that you guys didn't actually have to audition, but I'm guessing that maybe you've done some auditions in the past.
I've auditioned.
Okay.
I've auditioned.
Yeah. You want to hear a funny story? One time. I was...
yeah, no.
He knows. He knows what I'm going to say. So one time we were auditioning for I don't even know what, but it just so happened that Sam was going right before me. And so we were waiting behind the curtain to go on to the stage. And I'm waiting there, you know. I'm wearing nice clothes. I've brushed my hair.
Very serious.
If you know me, yeah, it's kind of a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting into the zone, and I look over my left shoulder, and what do I see? Sam is mooning me.
Yep.
As we're about to go on stage for
high
our audition.
High stakes.
I've done some auditions.
Oh, yeah. We're grizzled.
So what percentage would you say of plays that you've auditioned for that you've gotten? Or parts, rather.
Oh, that's a brutal question, because collegiate theater is so skewed. So, so skewed. It's, you know, you kind of have a certain role that happens, and you've done roles in collegiate theater, and you have experience, and they get to see you, and that all builds and builds and builds. And the older you get, the more you know about things, and so the higher the chance to get in. And so I've been fortunate, and I think Nick is similarly, that once we kind of entered the program, we were lucky enough to receive roles at the beginning. And then as we got older, the roles got more substantial and more challenging. So I can't say that I was ever kind of in need for roles, but I've definitely lost out on a few that I really, really wanted. But collegiate theater is the total opposite of real life theater, because, you know, for every role that I lost out on in collegiate theater, that's what I would maybe get in real life acting. I'd get cast once out of, you know, 40,000 auditions or something ridiculous. Yeah. You know, it's totally skewed. But that doesn't take away the nerves or the, like we were talking about before we started rolling, the awkwardness or any of those high stakes.
You know, the thing they tell you in acting school is, you know, just go out there. You don't have to, don't care about what they think about you. But you go into an audition and whether or not you get the role is entirely dependent on what they think of you. So,
right, you can't go out there chewing gum if you're playing. Right.
No, exactly. Like, it's like, don't, just be yourself.
But don't do that or that. Oh my gosh, you're wearing red to an audition.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, that's.
Yeah.
Was that something you've heard before? The red sounded very specific. Yeah,
the list goes on. We took a class and it was, you know, day in, day out saying don't. And a lot of it has merit and a lot of it doesn't. And it just is a matter of filtering through that and finding what works for you and what brings out the best of you to show the best of you to get the job.
So, in a lot of ways, auditioning is a very different skill set than actually acting.
1,000,000,000%. It's not even acting.
Yeah, it's so completely divorced from what you actually want to accomplish once you get a role. I guess, what would you say are the specific challenges of auditioning that you've had the most trouble adapting to, and what sort of tricks have you learned to face those obstacles or various fears or neuroses that come with the process?
You have to get the director, you have to get somebody out there to think, ooh, I could work with that. You know, you don't have to make the right decision necessarily, in so much that there is a right decision, which I don't think there is. You have to get people enthusiastic about you. I mean, I think as an actor, you have to be enthusiastic about what you're doing, but you don't have to be an enthusiastic character. And a lot of times you should not be an enthusiastic character. But you have to convey your enthusiasm to be up on stage.
Yeah. Well, and I've always thought about it like this. Auditions show that you can act, cut and dry. Callbacks, what happens right after an audition, shows that you can act a specific part, right? So you come into a big cattle call, there's 500 of us, and we have two monologues we get to do, 1 minute a piece, contrasting a serious and a comedic. And so that just shows, okay, here, I've gone to school, I have a BA, I can act. The director sees that, they say, okay, that kid's got some chops. Like, he's not going to get up there and just wet himself.
Melt.
For 45 minutes. Yeah. This kid, he's got, he or she has something. So they call you back, right? And then that focuses down into a specific role. Then they're trying to see, okay, here's Sam Bick. Can you do that role? Here's John Wilkes Booth. Can you do that role? Mm-hmm. And that's when you really get to do your acting. You know what I mean? The other one is just showing that you can polish up something that lasts a minute.
So you're on stage and the actor across from you, they're not bringing it. You feel like it might bring down your performance. How do you cope with that? Or is that not an experience you've even had?
No, I mean, I've acted across some real stinkers, but you just have to stay invested in your own work, really. And acting is so much give and take, that I feel, honestly, if you give and give and give, at some point they're going to realize that. They're going to realize that they are not giving. They're not giving. And that's the problem with weak actors, I think, in general, especially in a collegiate level, is it's a selfish thing. They're just take. And if you continue to give and you force that eye contact and you force that give and take, that's going to jolt them at least in a small level. And that also puts you in charge in a way. I don't know. That probably sounds selfish.
I think I'm a little bit more selfish than you are, because what I try to do in that setting is just something that they've never seen before.
Oh, amen.
You know,
yeah.
Just totally throw them a curveball and just, you know, how do they take it? Because, you know, if they've been used to hearing a line like, will you please pass me the salt? Will you please pass me the salt? Will you please pass me the salt? And it's just like they keep not passing you the salt. Then how are you going to do it differently?
Amen. Yeah. And that's just a different way of giving, right? I mean, give, 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 give.
Yeah. Okay.
same pig, different tinsel.
Yeah, I like this rapport.
Go back to what that one.
No, we're saying the same thing.
Give.
Entirely.
Just give.
So but I think throwing them a curveball is integral, because a lot of not giving is an actor getting stuck in a rut, and they might not even realize they're not giving.
Sure. You know? Well, and just not responding.
Amen.
And if you make it really obvious, hey, I'm giving you something different to respond to, please pick it up and throw it back at me. please.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I'm glad we had this.
There's a lot of trust you have to have when you're on stage and you're in that moment. Would you agree with that? That you have to trust that if you throw them that curveball or try to amp up the energy, mm-hmm. that they'll be perceptive. And I think that speaks, and you can tell me if I'm off base, but I think that speaks to sort of what separates a good actor from a bad actor is to be able to perceive those moments and react accordingly to them. And so you got to be willing to take risks, as cliche as that sounds. Does that make any sense?
It is a cliche, but I mean, it's something you hear in every single acting class ever. So, yeah, it's a cliche, but apparently it's not something that has gotten quite into everybody's skull because people keep saying it.
Right. And I mean, really earnest in the moment good acting is nothing short of the most risky thing because it's not pre-planned. It's not, okay, as soon as he says, will you please pass me the butter or salt or whatever it was that you were asking me to pass you, as soon as he says that, I'm going to do it this way. That's pre-planned. That's boring. It's not going to come, it's going to come across nothing but stale. Mm-hmm. And so if I just live in the moment and just trust that he's going to say it and I'm just going to react, that's when you start to get the sparks. That's when theater really starts to take off.
A very famous actor has said, acting is the easiest thing in the world. Just don't let him catch you.
Beautiful.
That is beautiful. So
earnest.
Tying in earnest. What you guys are saying sort of ties into my next question, which is a lot of the work and the process of acting, the stuff that people don't get to see, because what people see is just the performance as it's been created and handed to them. But a lot of the work comes to looking at a story and then breaking it down into scenes and then looking at the scenes and breaking those down into moments and then making decisions about how to exist in those moments from the character's point of view. And when you break it down into so many segments, there's going to be times where you're indecisive because you're torn between two thoughts, or you just plain old don't know. You feel like you've run out of ideas. If you've hit that point, when you hit that point, how do you push through it and find something to grab onto in those blank moments?
Well, I'd say that's when the really interesting stuff starts to happen. It's when you don't know what to do anymore. When the boredom seeps in, that's when you're really cooking. That's when you're being believable and earnest and sincere and truthful, is when you no longer know. It's like, well, I'm out of my bag of tricks. I knew these were going to work, and it's not working. Mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, that was just like Sam pretending to do this. Blah, boring. But when that starts to devolve into, oh, what am I going to do? And then you just react and just go back to that give and take.
Yeah. Well, you have to make a choice. I think one of the biggest risks, we talked about risks earlier, is making a choice, you know, making, just because it's easy to kind of sit there. It's like the same, and it's something I'm learning while doing these musicals. It's easy to kind of sing this sort of note that's not really a note, and it's kind of, but, you know, if you just make the decision, okay, I'm pretty, you know, I'm going to sing this note right now, you know, it's the same with making a choice.
Coming at it with confidence,
you know.
Strong and wrong.
Exactly.
That's my acting mantra.
Yeah. Sam's a director, too. He directs a lot of stuff.
No. Okay. Getting multiple separate perspectives.
So you're on stage.
Oh, that's where we are. Okay,
you forget your line. Yeah, that's right. We're on stage. Remember, guys?
Can't forget that.
It's a bad smelling person right over there. They're staring at you.
It's Nick.
You forget your line. How do you get through that? I've seen it.
Never
happened. I've seen it. But I was wondering, you always remember?
I've forgotten a line in a song in a vaudeville sketch in Virginia City working with Errol Koch.
Okay, how did you handle it?
I just bling bling.
No subtlety.
I think this is where the confidence comes back into
strong
play.
And wrong.
Yeah.
Strong if you're, they don't know. They don't know.
Yeah. I've forgotten lines, but never so bad that it was like a complete blank, a complete, you know, silent dead space.
Yeah, that terrifying story of every actor catches eyes and it's just,
yeah, you have nightmares about that.
Yeah.
Then that's why, I mean, that's why you got to learn your lines.
Learn them.
Have you been across from somebody who forgot their lines?
Not too bad. I mean, for me, it's
not like that. Yeah.
Yeah. You gotta just pick up the cues. You gotta.
Right. Yeah. And another thing is collegiate theater, which we have just recently both gotten out of, is so, so rehearsed. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite of professional theater. You rehearse for 2 months and you perform for 2 weeks. Whereas in professional theater, you rehearse for, you know, 2-3 weeks and you perform for 2 months. It's like, if you're forgetting your lines after 2 months, it's just, but you know, you go and you do summer stock, like I was saying with Virginia City, and that's the total, it's back to the 1 week, 2 week rehearsal process.
Yeah. I've heard some horror stories though. Everyone has.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's a good one?
Well, I heard it just recently. I heard of some people who did the same scene like 3 or 4 times.
I love those.
They just got stuck in a loop, like some sort of weird scratched record in heaven.
Or hell.
Yeah. It just kept happening.
On the play.
I mean, the audience was like, I loved how you like tied in Groundhog Day.
Yeah, what was your favorite scene? Well, the one you did 15 times, I guess.
Apparently, they didn't even notice.
And I wouldn't. They wouldn't, would they? I don't know. They would think that it was some bizarre. They'd go, I didn't get that choice.
And that's the thing.
That's okay.
There's some like absurdist playwrights who actually have written in. Like they, I mean, I think Waiting for Godot is a classic example. Sure. It's like the second act is virtually the same as the first act. Still one of the greatest plays of all time.
One of the forgotten line horror stories I've experienced, when I was in high school, I did a show, and I was a senior at this point, and there was a girl, she was a sophomore, sweet kid, didn't have the, just whatever memorization process she was using did not work for her. And on the night of the show, she was actually barreling through. She was doing so good relative to what we expected. She was doing so good until one scene, a little after the middle of the show, she forgets a line, just one line. The scene we pick up for, the scene goes on as normal. Her confidence was just crushed. So she spent the entire rest of the scene unmoving, frozen to her spot, and did not say another one of her lines. Wow. She knew them just fine. She was just so scared of messing up again that she just stayed rooted to the ground. And then as soon as everybody cleared out, she just cleared out with them.
She sucked.
That's a meltdown.
Yeah, that's... I wish I had a story like that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, every actor has flubs, I think, but you have to forgive yourself. Sure. You just have to forgive yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot like being a quarterback. If you throw an interception, you have to move on. You got to have a short memory when you're on stage.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, you go crazy and you wind up trying to kill the president.
Sounds familiar.
Something I wanted to ask you guys. I am very much an actor first. Like I love the craft of acting, and acting in a musical is a very different breed of acting than acting in a straight dramatic play or for a camera or what have you. And so from my perspective, I come into these characters looking actor first and sort of bring the music in secondarily. Do you do something similar? How does the music factor into your acting process if it's something out of the norm for you?
Well, it is out of the norm for me, but I think I approach the songs like acting the songs in much the same way I'd approach, you know, acting a scene. Or, well, first you look at objective, you know, you look at your tactics, what do you want and how are you going to get what you want? And a lot of the times, I mean, the song provides you with a lot of those tactics. You know, you have a high note here, you have this interval, which is a recurrent kind of theme throughout the song. And you can find a way to use that to get what you want. The way I made this work for me as someone who doesn't have any experience really with musical theater is to attack the songs as I would a monologue or a scene. Cause that was the easiest way for me to relate. The thought of acting a song is kind of weird.
So when you get the actual script in your hands, how is it that you memorize everything? Do you just read it over and over again? Or
Yeah, it's just hours, man. It's just, I mean, and it's a muscle, just like everything else. You know, I my girlfriend's an actress, and she hasn't been acting as much frequently as I have, and it takes her a lot longer to memorize than it used to. And I'm right now in a spout of acting where I've been acting a lot, and I can pick up a monologue that I'm doing in the show and memorize it in, you know, 6 hours. If I just really put my nose to it, it's perfect in 6 hours. And it just doesn't matter. I mean, there's systems out there. There's so many systems. I have yet to encounter. I mean, there's like, you write the first letter of each word.
That's what Robert Downey Jr. does.
Sure. Yeah. And that's great for Robert Downey Jr. But that
that's
just
great gets, for Robert Downey Jr.
That just gets me so confused.
RDJ.
So
RDJ.
We won't be seeing you in an Iron Man suit anytime soon.
Well, not on stage. No. In my off time, maybe. But I don't know what you're doing in my bedroom, so please leave. But no, I don't know. I just think you just got to put your nose to it and just put the hours in, and that's all it takes.
You got to treat it like work.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. So I find, like, the number one question people will ask you, you're an actor? Oh, how do you memorize that stuff? And it's weird because it's like, that's the absolute baseline.
The given
situation. You have to do that. You know, it's like, you don't ask a postal worker, how do you put all those letters in those boxes? It's like, I just do. That's my job.
Right.
I did a play in high, well, sort of. I almost did a play in high school.
Did you forget your lines and then not leave stage?
No, so what happened was there was a girl that I kind of liked, and she was trying to get me to do this two-person play, and I was like, all right, yeah, I always wanted to act. This would be great. And so I had we're supposed to do something funny, so I'm like, I can do this. Like, I was all about it, and then I look at it, and the script is huge.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's probably not that big, but it looked really big to me, and yeah. I worked at it for, like, 3 weeks, and I was finally like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Like, I just shut it down. I could not memorize it.
And your brain, that muscle wasn't flexed, you know? Yeah. So jumping in is always going to be harder. Yeah. Always. You know, I've noticed after doing summer stock theater and not having to memorize so much for a certain summer, and then you go into a play and all of a sudden you've got all these lines. I'm just like, I'm never going to do this. Never going to happen. Then at the end of a school year, if you're doing college, it's like, I got that. Yeah, that's cake.
Yeah, but it seems like every script I've ever gotten to and the process of memorization, I've always come to a point where I'm just like, maybe I actually just can't do this anymore.
Yeah, yeah. You do reach that moment where I was like, we have to consider the possibility that maybe I just suck now.
Yeah. Am I broken?
And you get down to the end and it's you're saying there instead of they are, and you've gotten that line note 45 times, and you could murder the stage manager, and you're like, no, that line's never going to be right. I'm sorry. But then all of a sudden in the middle of the show, you're like, oh, I just said it right. It just, you know, somehow it works its way out.
So do you break them down part by part, or do you just go through the whole thing? And
Yeah. I usually go half a page at a time if it's really, 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 if I have a lot of lines, like a monologue, for instance. I'll say I got a half a page paragraph of text. I can usually memorize a paragraph of text within, I don't know, an hour.
Yeah, it depends for me. It depends. But I usually pick out a spot like, okay, this is a good chunk. I'm going to get this memorized, then I'll move on to the next, and so on.
And it's, you know, it depends on the way that the script is written, too. Different scripts are easier and more difficult to memorize. I think Shakespeare's easier to memorize.
Yeah, a lot of people would disagree. Yeah.
And a lot of people would disagree. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say that. We're going to get in a fist fight over this podcast. Oh, shit. Let me at him.
So is it easier for you if there's like a rhythm to the words? Or?
There's always a rhythm. There's every playwright that's worth his weight has a rhythm.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I was
finding it. That's when.
Yeah. The hardest thing I ever had to memorize, and I've had some. The role I was in before this, I played a zombie, a talking zombie, and I just spoke gibberish. Wonder Bread, Red Bull, Manifest, Destinies, and Toes and Knees, and Toasty Marshmallow, Furs and Spice, and Everything Spice, 2% Tennial Shopping Spree, not to be, that is the question, onion and pickles, please, without fancy ketchup. See, that's not so bad, but then...
That is a verbose
It just
zombie.
Keeps going it's on like that. It just keeps thing. Going. But then I had this really the hardest time I ever had was my boss. It was for Summer Stock Theater Company, and my boss wrote this play, and it was the worst thing I've ever seen.
What was it called? No, I'm kidding.
I'll tell you. Secure...
Then I'll definitely want to hear.
It was called, okay, and this is an underwear joke. I'll preface security breaches.
Wow. Not even briefs?
No.
security breeches. Make more
That's
sense.
So much is, better.
Yeah, the only time I've ever been in drag on stage, which was worth it. That was actually the high point of the show. But it was just terrible, and it was so hard to memorize because it's like human beings don't think like this.
Sure.
I mean, I can't even, you know, awful. Just awful.
Let's zoom in
from the greater craft of acting, let's zoom in more specifically on the roles you're playing in Assassins. Mm-hmm. What do you do to relate to someone who is nothing like you, or in some ways some things like you, but took a very different path, especially in a case where they've done something incredibly drastic that, and I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth when I say you would never do.
Well, for me, it all starts in the manner of speech, and it totally does. I mean, if you have a character with a very strong accent who comes from a certain part of the country, I mean, the South was a very war-torn place at the end of the Civil War. It's not hard at all to imagine how someone would want revenge.
That was actually very poetic.
You have to find the similarities, at least in the beginning. And if not, you have to you have to convince yourself
that there are some,
that you can go there, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if you can't go there, then there's no use in even trying, right? I mean, it's just a matter of finding truth in the character, no matter how drastic that is. And I think that if you can find that truth, then you can be believable for the whole role. And it is really, really difficult with a character that has done something, but you can't live in that moment, right? You have to just live in before that. You can't play the end of the scene at the beginning of the scene because you don't know that yet. Even if I know that I'm going to hijack a plane, I haven't gotten to that point yet. So at the juncture where I'm playing Sam Vick, he's just as good as me because he is disenfranchised with the government. He feels lost. He feels useless. He feels all of these things. He hasn't done anything yet. He's thought about them. I haven't thought about them, but I can put myself in a place where I can consider them. And that's the launching off point. And so it's just a matter of going there, really, for me.
It's all about taking risks and confidence. I feel like that's what we've learned. Okay, so last question from this mic. This is directed to both of you. Put yourself on the other side of the assassin's gun. If you had to jump in front of a bullet to save one president, which president would you save?
Gerald Ford.
All right, and why?
That was a... He doesn't.
Because in so many ways... Well, I thought about saying Richard Nixon just to see if I could get an uproar. And my reasoning would be because his middle name is Milhouse. I don't know. I didn't have any reasoning. And I don't really have any reasoning for Gerald Ford, but he's just such a bumbling, beautiful man-child. Just there's this beautiful moment in our production. There's this beautiful moment in our production where the ladies that are trying to assassinate him realize he says, I'm Jerry Ford. And they say, President Jerry Ford? And Chris, the actor, has this beautiful moment where he says, yeah, it's just as shocking to me. I am President Jerry Ford. And that is so earnest and believable and truthful and rooted in the actual Jerry Ford to me that it's like, he didn't want to be there. What is he doing? Jeez. So I guess I'd jump in front of Jerry Ford.
All right.
No one. I wouldn't jump in front of anyone. I just wouldn't do it.
It's not worth it to
you? I just straight up wouldn't do it. I would love to think of a good answer to
that. What about Garfield?
What about him?
Without Garfield, there would be no comic strip.
No lasagna.
Really?
We would all love Mondays.
Was he the basis for
100%. Garfield? You didn't know that that's political satire?
I guess Garfield.
So we got an answer.
Yeah.
This is really awkward because I was going to say Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Who now?
Who's that? Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like the show?
Thank you guys so much for coming in. The show is November 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, and 20th, 21st, 22nd. So that's a Friday, Saturday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
So today I watched the movie The Blue Room. This is a French film that's, I guess, an erotic whodunit. There's a lot of subtitles, but the way that they pace it, there's visual things going on, but they hold on things long enough to where you can read what's going on and then see the action without missing anything. So it's about a husband who winds up having an affair with a woman whose husband owns a prominent pharmacy in town. Seems to be falling deeper into this affair, and we get hints right away that she's going to off her husband. We also learn along the way that he is ill, and so he doesn't have long, so it's not necessarily cut and dried that she is going to kill him. So that's one element of did she or didn't she. I don't want to give away a lot about this movie because it's very vague in its ending, and I don't think I'm spoiling anything here, but there are at least four possibilities of what could have happened in this movie. And one thing that I really enjoyed about this is American films, very rare is the occasion where they have an ending where they really leave it open and leave it for people to decide. Mm-hmm. You really have to gather the few facts that they give and people's reaction to things for you to decide what exactly went down. The way that I basically looked at it is the possibilities are the wife could have killed her husband and then killed his wife.
Mm-hmm.
She might have not killed her husband and it was an accident, but then he killed his wife. She might have killed both of them. Or a fourth thing that I will not reveal, but I'm betting if people watch it, there's a subtle thing in there, but I think there is a potential twist. But once again, it's left on you to decide what exactly, you know, it meant.
So they want to play a lot with ambiguity in the way we perceive this story and these characters.
Definitely. And the thing that really stands out at me the most is the facial expressions that people give. Mm-hmm. The lead of the movie.
Mathieu Amari. Yeah. I can say with 70% certainty. That's how you pronounce his name. He's also the writer and director of the film.
Okay. He does an excellent job of just the facial expressions he gives during the movie. He's really good at kind of deadpanning a lot of scenes, but just the little twinges of things that he does really speak volumes in this movie. And it spends a lot of the movie where you're watching him, you're just like, wow, this guy is so over his head. And why he's over his head is on you to really decide, you know, is he involved in this murder? Is he not? Is it a murder to begin with? Like, once again, there are a lot of questions and there are not a lot of answers, but I feel like the journey through it was interesting. It's definitely not done in a way that I've seen an American movie.
Interesting.
And it's not meant to be insulting when I say this, but your typical movie in the States, they're going to spoon feed you a lot of things, you know? They don't, like, if they have subtle things, they really stand out in the movie. Mm-hmm. And this really is not that way at all, you know? It's left on us to do all the work in our head.
So this is not the kind of movie that's going to talk down to you and walk you through everything?
No, not at all. Not on either front. I mean, even with her reactions, you really can't tell if she's setting him up. Is she crazy and doing this, or is it just sort of misunderstandings? There was definitely a murder in the movie. As to whether her husband's murdered or not, we just don't know for sure.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. You know, it was definitely a good escape to sit in there and kind of watch it and just lose yourself in it. I'd also like to say, I haven't watched a movie for a while that hasn't been in an aspect ratio that would be like widescreen.
Oh, sure.
And at first I was like, well, that's kind of a strange choice, but somehow it feels a lot bigger than it is on the screen.
Oh, that's cool. So having that sort of the aspect ratio he's referring to this film being in is that that classic.
Is that 4:3?
Yeah, the classic 4:3 golden age of Hollywood, like box square.
Yeah, like you could put it on an old school TV and it would look perfect. Wouldn't miss anything.
And it's interesting that you bring that up, how choosing to shoot in that race, that ratio sort of lends a grandiosity to the proceedings, even for the mundane stuff, just by how much it takes up of the screen.
Yeah, it's really strange. So one of the things that really struck me when DVD became popular, you know, I was one of those guys who's always, when widescreen came out on VHS, I'd be like, yeah, why do you want to watch this? And then when DVD came out, it was a whole nother ball game because the pictures look so muddy when you watched it on a TV screen before, and you would see it in the movie theater, but it never really translated on the small screen until DVDs started coming out, and then obviously later Blu-ray. But when I watch this, somehow they frame things so that, you know, they do a lot of pull away shots where they're, for example, there's a scene at a beach and you see the whole beach in one part, and it just, it looks so big, and it's just, it's amazing how you could do that with this small box, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So I really think whoever did the cinematography on this really did an incredible job for what they had. And I don't know if it was an artistic choice to do it in 4:3 or not, but if it was, you could certainly make a case that they did a great job at it, because it's stunning for being 4:3. And I can't think of anything else that I would necessarily say that in.
Interesting. Okay.
You know, there hasn't been a show in a long, long time that looked good that wasn't in a widescreen.
Yeah, I think the last major film that came out in 4:3 was The Artist.
Okay. I actually missed that one.
Sure. So. Okay. I want to ask about the themes of Blue Room a little bit. Something that sort of struck me, I sort of see a parallel with Blue Room and Gone Girl. And now, like the rest of America, you and I have seen Gone Girl. Mm-hmm. And with, I mean, even going past sort of the superficial plot similarities, I'm wondering how much thematically they're covering the same ground in terms of, it, say, a perspective on both relationships and investigation into domestic issues.
You know, they're really not covering the same ground as Gone Girl. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, did the husband do it or not?
Right,
there,
that question's
which
present.
Is really like a kind of a genre thing anyway.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
This movie, it doesn't play with really any of the ideas that Gone Girl does.
Okay, so they,
outside of the ambiguity as to whether he did it or not. But even in Gone Girl, there's clues both ways that hit you over the head in that mm-hmm. movie. There are no such clues in this movie.
Okay.
You know? And it's not a commentary on how investigators look at something, which was very apparent in Gone Girl. This is more, if anything, I would say it's a character study.
Okay.
And maybe that's why there aren't a lot of answers. And I just saw this, so I guess I'm working through this as we're talking.
For full disclosure, he walked out of this like a half hour ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and we had to record quick to get this up. But so I am decompressing these thoughts as I go, so I
Absolutely.
Apologize if I'm not as in-depth as people would like me to be. But there's a lot of character studying in this of the main character, and it's really his story.
Mm-hmm.
And you see other people in the peripheral of looking at him, and you have to make decisions on them
based on how reliable their perspective is and
off of his perspective.
Okay.
He is if he's not in every scene,
he's in close to it.
He is crucial to every scene. Like, this is very much a story in his eyes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But as in terms of if there's any murders that happen, he's not giving it in the movie. So,
okay. Yeah. So you got it. Okay. Now the actor, we talked about him a little bit earlier, Mathieu Amalric, he's huge in France, like a superstar in France. He's crossed over in America to varying degrees of success. He was the bad guy Dominic in Quantum of Solace.
Yes.
He was.
And does a great job in that, by the way.
Yes. He's the lead in Diving Bell and a Butterfly, which is a beautiful film if you haven't seen it. Very beautiful film. Now, this is the first time he's written a screenplay, which is adapted from a fairly well-known book by a Belgian writer named Georges Simenon. And it's his first time behind the camera as a director. So did this feel like knowing nothing about this guy going in, did this feel like a rookie directing?
No. No, it felt very masterfully done. I mean,
yeah.
I could see now knowing that he was the director,
uh-huh.
that makes sense that, you know, it hangs on him a lot. It definitely plays to his strengths.
Okay.
And so I think that was definitely something that the film benefited from, was the fact that he knew where he could hang, you know, in front of the camera and how long. Because that's the thing, they would pay scenes where you would just be watching him for, you know, 2-3 minutes giving mm-hmm. responses to police officers. And that could have been grueling and boring
in
you know, with a lot of actors.
And,
yeah, in different hands. But he really knows where to make the cut and how long to hang on everything, you know?
Sure.
So, like I said, it's a slower pace, but it's the right pace for this movie, clearly. Did he do the editing as well?
I don't have the full crew in front of me. I believe in my research, he was involved with the editing, but he was not the primary editor. There was another name. The editor was François Jedigier, and the cinematographer you were talking about earlier is Christophe Boncarn.
One other thing I really wanted to mention in this movie, there are orchestral swells throughout this movie, and you don't even really realize there's not a lot of music through most of the movie until the swells happen in the big emotional parts. Mm-hmm. And it's just done so well. So much of it conveys what's happening because everything's so tight-lipped,
mm-hmm.
you know, with this character, which you can understand if you're in front of police officers being interrogated.
Be yeah.
You're not going to want to volunteer a whole lot. That's played right, but it's definitely punctuated by the music that they do choose to put in. And I don't know why, but there are certain swells in this movie that really reminded me of The Godfather, which is
Ooh.
An ultimate compliment.
Ooh,
to me,
that's high
one
high
of
praise.
My favorite movies. And but it's not, the music isn't prominent like The Godfather. They definitely pick their spots, but where they pick it, it really works.
Interesting.
You know, and it's a lot of orchestra building,
mm-hmm. a lot of crescendos.
Not, but it doesn't necessarily crescendo into anything. It's just building and building and building, and then it just slowly fades out.
Okay.
You know, and they do a really great job of calling your attention to emotions that might be there that are very, very small. And I think that's a real credit to whoever did the music for
so
this movie.
It sort of sounds like the key word for this movie is subtlety. It's handled yeah. with a degree of sort of self-awareness and subtlety in every decision that's made along the creative process.
It's definitely one of the most subtle movies I've seen in a long, long time.
That's
so.
A quality I'm married to. I'm going to go hard pitch for the listeners out there for a second. For those of you who are still on the fence, if you are listening to us talk about it and thinking, well, this sounds interesting, but a slow pace, it's probably a long, pretentious French movie. Guess what, guys? 76-minute runtime.
Yeah.
You're in and out of this thing in under an hour and a half.
Yeah, and like I said, the long scenes, they don't feel long.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny you said 76 minutes, because I really figured it was like a two-hour movie. I didn't know.
Yeah.
But it felt the right run length.
It felt
it
like
is.
It was supposed to be. So that's another credit to the editor that, I mean, being, because it sounds like there's so much they could have either kept in or brought in, depending on what type of scene it was and whether it was in the screenplay.
I'm willing to bet there's some things that hit the cutting room floor. I'd be interested in reading the book just to know if there's more definite answers in the book, because it very well might have been a choice to leave out a lot of those answers and mm-hmm. just leave it vague so that people had to kind of draw their conclusions. And if that was a choice, it was definitely a good choice, because it just works, man. I don't know how to sell this movie to you in any other way other than it really works and you should see it.
Yes, please do. Please come by the Myrna Loy Center. It's going to be held over for at least another week. Please come by and check it out. You won't have to try to leave home in the cold at midnight if you come see it. If you're not in Montana, just take a look around, see if it's playing near you. Because if it is, this is one worth checking out. It's a unique type of movie that you don't get to see a lot of. You know, support independent film. Support filmmakers like Mathieu Amalric, where you see a lot of these actors who go into writing and directing and they do their own project. They have a tendency to be sort of precious about the movie in general and afraid to cut out the fat, and also precious about their performance and their vanity. And Mathieu Amalric has none of this.
No.
None of it. He does not have the type of ego or vanity that would allow him to single-handedly balloon this movie into something sort of swollen and unnecessary and bloated.
And since we're talking about this, let's just put all the cards on the table. There's a lot of tentpole movies out there, and I'm no different than anybody else.
Anyone who's listened to us podcasts before knows very well that we are in for the overwhelming majority of blockbusters.
Yes. But, you know, there is room for the smaller movies, and we're not seeing them outside of independent cinema anymore,
mm-hmm.
or from movies from other countries. I mean, this is where we're seeing those smaller movies that touch a lot of lives when you see them, you know?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It's really important to see these movies when they come out, because otherwise they're going to go away.
And it's especially important to come out and see them when they're good, and especially when they're really good, like
right.
this one, when they stand out from the back.
Yeah, I'm not saying to just support anything, but
yeah.
support pieces of cinema.
Because this is how you get more of it. And if you're the type of person who maybe doesn't watch French films all that often outside of maybe once or twice a year firing something up on Netflix, you know, put your foot out and put your toe in the water. The water's fine. Come join us.
Yeah, and I'll put it out there. You know how many French films I've seen? One. And I just talked about it. So You know, I'm not wearing a beret here. Really enjoyed this movie.
This is not a pretentious, angry that he didn't have his own film career critic telling you this. This is two guys who just really love going to movies and love the entertainment value of them.
I haven't even smoked a closed cigarette in like 15 years. So
that seems as good a place to cut this off as any.
Thank you once again for joining us here on the Thin Men podcast. Special thanks to Sam Williamson and Nick Pavlich for dropping by and talking to us. Thanks for the Myrna Loy Center for allowing us to talk about and see the Blue Room. Please come see the Assassins at the Myrna Loy Center on the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, and the 20th, 21st, and 22nd of November. The Blue Room will be here through next Thursday and possibly longer if people are coming out to see it.
And then also, I just want to close with saying the piece of music you're hearing right now is a band in Helena, Montana called Tonight We Ride. You can listen to this song and many others on an album called Of the West, which you can download for free, or you can pay a few shekels if you want to, and stay with us.